2004. 2 years into an FBI investigation of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, the largest political lobbying group in the United States with over 65,000 members whose job is to run the United States government on behalf of Israel, which the FBI suspect is a spy front for Israel, Ashkenazi Jew, Larry Franklin, a mid-level Pentagon analyst in the employ of Douglas Feith, is observed by the FBI giving classified information to two officials of APAC suspected of being Israeli spies. He is subsequently sentenced to 12 years in prison in 2006. Interestingly, Douglas Feith was fired from the United States National Security Council, NSC, in March 1982 and lost his security clearance after he fell under suspicion of the FBI for passing classified material to Israeli embassy officials. APAC hires lawyer Nathan Lewin to handle their legal defense, the same lawyer who defended suspected Israeli spy Stephen Breyer in 1978. Also, Larry Franklin worked in the Pentagon Office of Special Plans, run by Richard Paul, at the time Paul, who was caught giving classified information to Israel back in 1970, was insisting that Iraq was riddled with weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, and the United States therefore must invade and conquer Iraq, as soon as possible. There were no WMDs, of course, and Paul dumped the blame for the bad intelligence on CIA Director George Tenet, real name Cohen, another crypto Jew. But what does come to light is that the Pentagon Office of Special Plans was coordinating with a similar group in Israel, based in Ariel Sharon's office, with two suspected Israeli spies, at least, inside the office from which the lies that launched the war in Iraq originated. It soon becomes crystal clear that the people of the United States are the victims of a deadly hoax, a hoax that started a war using the blood and money of American citizens for the purposes of Israeli oppression. The leaking of the investigation of APAC by the Jewish media on August 28, this year, gives advance warning to all the other spies who had been working with Franklin. As if it couldn't get any worse, the damage to the FBI's investigation is completed when United States Attorney General John Ashcroft orders the FBI to stop all arrests in the case. Like the Stephen Breyer case and the hunt for MEGA, this latest spy scandal seems destined to be whitewashed by officials who have their own secret allegiances to protect, barring a massive public outcry. At the beginning of March, dual Israeli-slash-American citizen and Jewish rabbi, Dov Zakheim, resigns as the Pentagon controller and chief financial officer when it is revealed in an audit of the Pentagon budget that he is unable to account for the disappearance of $2.6 trillion including defense inventory of 56 airplanes, 32 tanks, and 36 Javelin missile command launch units. Interestingly, the United States government claim this cannot be investigated further, because, allegedly, the records which would need to be studied to investigate this matter were destroyed in the attack on the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. On May 20, Senator Ernest Hollings, who is not running for a further term, decides to speak out about Israel's control of America, which he does on the floor of the Senate, firstly declaring that President Bush went to war in Iraq to secure our friend, Israel, and everybody knows it, and then he makes the following statement about APAC's control of America: "You can't have an Israel policy other than what APAC gives you around here. I have followed them mostly in the main, but I have also resisted signing certain letters from time to time, to give the poor president a chance. I can tell you no president takes office, I don't care whether it is a Republican or a Democrat, that all of a sudden APAC will tell him exactly what the policy is." In June, independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader echoes Senator Hollings' comments when he states what has been happening over the years is a predictable routine of foreign visitation from the head of the Israeli government. The Israeli puppeteer travels to Washington. The Israeli puppeteer meets with the puppet in the White House, and then moves down Pennsylvania Avenue, and meets with the puppets in Congress. And then takes back billions of taxpayer dollars. Police near the nuclear fuel services plant in Tennessee stop a truck after a 3-mile chase, during which the driver throws a bottle containing a strange liquid from the cab. The drivers turn out to be Israelis using fake identifications. The FBI refuses to investigate and the Israelis are released. Two Israelis try to enter Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base, home to 8 Trident submarines. The truck tests positive for explosives. The national director of the Abraham H. Foxman, publishes a book entitled, Never Again, The Threat of the New Anti-Semitism, in which he states that the New Testament's lie, that the ancient Pharisees were responsible for the death of Christ, has been responsible for anti-Semitism throughout the millennia, and thus the New Testament of the Bible is hate speech, and should be censored or, preferably, banned. On April 21, Israeli nuclear weapons whistleblower Mordechai Vaynanu is released from prison after serving 18 years, over 11 of which was spent in a 2-meter by 3-meter cell in solitary confinement, during which time he was only allowed occasional visits from his family, lawyer and a priest. Even though he is released from prison after serving his full sentence, he is not allowed to leave Israel and is not allowed to speak to foreign media. In northern Nigeria, Islamic leaders claim a United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, polio immunization campaign is part of a United States plot to depopulate the region by spreading AIDS or sterilizing agents, as the northern states say their own lab tests show contaminants in the vaccine. In order to prove the vaccine is safe, the United States government sends a team of scientists, religious leaders and others abroad to witness tests on the vaccine in foreign labs. However, once the tests are completed, they refuse to release the results. Mel Gibson releases his film, The Passion of the Christ. To preserve its authenticity, the dialogue of the film is presented entirely in Aramaic and Latin with subtitles. However, there is one subtitle that does not appear. It is spoken, but for some reason the subtitle is removed. This is of course due to pressure from Jewish media. The scene from which the subtitle was removed was when Pilate was trying to get the Jews to stop calling for Jesus Christ's crucifixion. And what was it the Jews said in response to Pilate? That the powerful Jewish lobby were so desperate to censor, "Let his blood be on us and our children." On June 20th, according to a report in the Jerusalem Post, the Israeli Knesset has now empowered the State of Israel to criminalize anyone in the world who dares to question whether or not 6 million Jews died in the alleged Holocaust, and request their extradition to Israel. Furthermore, the Israeli government can also seize, prosecute and imprison people who harbor such beliefs, should they ever set foot in Israel. On September 30th, during his first presidential debate with the Jew John Kerry, President Bush states, on the subject of Americans dying in the war in Iraq, a free Iraq will help secure Israel. On October 16, President Bush signs into law the Global Anti-Semitism Review Act, designed to force the entire world into never being critical of the Jews, whatever their actions. This act establishes a special department within the United States State Department to monitor global anti-Semitism, which is to report annually to Congress. This act defines a person as being anti-Semitic if they purport any of the following beliefs. 1. Any assertion that the Jewish community controls government, the media, international business and the financial world. 2. The expression of strong anti-Israel sentiment. 3. Expressing virulent criticism of Israel's leaders, past or present. The State Department gives an example of this occurring when a swastika is portrayed in a cartoon decrying the behavior of a past or present Zionist leader. 4. Any criticism of the Jewish religion or its religious leaders or literature with the emphasis on the Talmud and Kabbalah. 5. Any criticism of the United States government and Congress for being under undue influence by the Jewish Zionist community, which would include Jewish organizations such as American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC. 6. Any criticism of the Jewish Zionist community for promoting globalism or what some call the New World Order. 7. Placing any blame on Jewish leaders and their followers for inciting the Roman crucifixion of Christ. 8. Citing any facts that could in any way diminish the 6 million figure of Holocaust victims. 9. Claiming that Israel is a racist state. 10. Making any claim that there exists a Zionist conspiracy. 11. Offering proof that Jews and their leaders created communism and the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. 12. Making derogatory statements about Jewish persons. 13. Asserting that spiritually disobedient Jews do not have the biblical right to reoccupy Palestine. 14. Making any allegations of Mossad involvement in the 9/11 attack. 2005. On January 20th, President Bush makes the following statement as part of his second inaugural address when our founders declared a new order of the ages. This is not true. The founders did not declare a new order of the ages, the Jew, President Roosevelt did when in 1933. He put its Latin translation, Novus Ordo Seclorum, on the dollar bill. On February 15th, the Jew Michael Chertoff is sworn in as the head of the United States Department of Homeland Security. As previously stated, Chertoff is a dual United States/Israeli citizen. His father was a rabbi and his mother was one of the first Mossad agents. On February 27th, Nation of Islam leader, Louis Farrakhan, makes the following statement with regard to the Jewish domination in the trade of African slaves to America. Listen, Jewish people don't have no hands that are free of the blood of us. They owned slave ships, they bought and sold us. They raped and robbed us. On July 7th, three stations on the London Underground's network and a London double-decker bus are bombed, resulting in the deaths of 52 people. This is blamed on so-called Al-Qaeda suicide bombers. However, this is not the only parallel with the attack on September 11, 2001 in America. Here are some of the other interesting parallels. 1. At the times and places the separate bombings on the London Underground occur, a crisis management company known as Visor Consultants is carrying out terror drills of the same event. This is confirmed in separate interviews on both Radio 5 and Britain's most popular television station ITVA, with the consultancy's managing director, Peter Power. In the Radio 5 interview, he states, at 9:30 this morning we were actually running an exercise for a company of over 1,000 people in London based on simultaneous bombs going off precisely at the railway stations where it happened this morning. So I still have the hairs on the back of my neck standing up right now. Readers may recall that the reason planes were not immediately scrambled on September 11, 2001, the day of the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, was, according to the United States government, because a drill of the same event was occurring at the same time on that day, which caused confusion to the security services, who couldn't work out if an attack on America was actually taking place or if it was a dream. Why do people not find it suspicious when a terror drill run at the same time at three London Underground stations? It is important to note that the London Underground's network consists of 274 stations, so picking three stations represent just over 1% of the stations they could have picked, actually becomes reality as an actual attack on the same three London Underground stations. Unfortunately, the general public do not use their brains and instead allow their thinking to be done for them by a Jewish-owned media. Why would a trained journalist not follow up such a blatant smoking gun, especially when the man who made these claims, Peter Power, now refuses to discuss the matter any further? The answer is obvious: a journalist would not make that decision, and it can only be assumed the journalists collectively have been instructed not to investigate the matter further by the owners of the media, Jewish owners. As for the reason for running a terror drill whilst the attacks were taking place, the most likely reason is to provide an alibi for the actual perpetrators of the attack, who knew about this drill. The way this would work is that if any of the real bombers were caught acting suspiciously, they could claim that they were only part of the drill and they would have the alibi to back that up. This would of course mean that the alleged perpetrators, four Muslim men, were not involved in the attack. 2. The authorities claim that personal documents relating to each of the so-called bombers were found at each of the bomb scenes. This is another strange coincidence between the attack on the World Trade Center, when authorities there claimed that although they could not find traces of bodies, a pristine paper passport belonging to one of the hijackers had been found. 3. Israel's finance minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is in London on the morning of the attacks in order to attend an economic conference in a hotel over the underground station where one of the blasts occurred, but stays in his hotel room instead after he had been informed by Israeli intelligence officials attacks were expected. This is another similarity with the attacks on America, when 4,000 Jews were warned not to go to work in the World Trade Center that day. How come it's only Jews who get prior warning about alleged Al-Qaeda terrorism? Following the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, there are now only 5 nations on the world left without a Rothschild-owned central bank: Iran, North Korea, Sudan, Cuba, and Libya. Interestingly, the satellite state of Israel, more commonly known as the United States government, chooses to refer to these countries as rogue nations. Physics professor Stephen E. Jones of Brigham Young University publishes a paper in which he proves the World Trade Center buildings could have only been brought down in the manner they were by explosives. He receives no coverage in the mainstream media for his scientifically provable claims. On September 30, Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten publishes 12 so-called cartoons, most of which depict the Muslim prophet Muhammad, something it is against the Islamic faith to do, regardless of what he might be doing. These cartoons are subsequently reprinted in over 50 countries, resulting in large-scale protests by the worldwide Muslim community. This is exactly why they were printed: to inflame the tensions between the Western world and the Muslim community and encourage the Western world and the Muslim community to be further alienated so they can fight amongst each other until only the Jews are left. The cultural editor of Jyllands-Posten responsible for the original publication of these cartoons, Fleming Rose, a Jew. On October 30, the head of the Kabbalah Center in Israel, Shaul Yudkovich, is arrested for extracting money from a cancer patient. Over a period of a few months, the victim donated $36,000 to the Kabbalah Center after she was told by Yudkovich that the donation would improve her condition. When her condition did not improve, other rabbis at the Kabbalah Center in Tel Aviv suggested she make a significant and painful donation. As a result, she donated a further $25,000 and also purchased some holy water from the Kabbalah Center at an exorbitant price. She eventually ran out of money, so the rabbis then suggested her husband give up work and instead work for free at the Kabbalah Center. The victim then died and her husband went to the police to report this extortion. Interestingly, Shaul Yudkovich is one of the main teachers of the Kabbalah worldwide and was directly responsible for Madonna's visit to Israel in 2004. On November 15, Robert Stein Jr., an American felon, who was employed as a controller for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, is charged with fraud and accepting kickbacks and pleads guilty to the charges. Stein, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Wheeler and Lieutenant Colonel Deborah Harrison were accused of accepting kickbacks of $200,000 per month from Philip Bloom in return for awarding questionable contracts. A New York Times article commenting on Stein's administration of reconstruction funds from Iraq's soil revenue states for reasons that the Pentagon has so far declined to clarify, Stein was hired as a controller by the Coalition Provisional Authority and put in charge of $82 million for reconstruction, despite his conviction for felony fraud in the 1990s. In November, a group of conservative to moderate Democrats called Blue Dog Coalition that focus on the fiscal responsibility of government, report that Jewish President George W. Bush has borrowed more money from banks and foreign governments than all the previous 42 United States presidents combined. Treasury Department figures show that from 1776, 2000, all the previous American presidents borrowed a total of $1.01 trillion, whereas in the past 4 years alone, the Bush administration has borrowed $1.05 trillion. On December 5, following accusations from Holocaust revisionists that World War II leaders never mentioned the alleged Holocaust of the Jews in gas chambers, Richard Lynn, professor emeritus at the University of Ulster, reports his research into this matter as follows. I've checked out Churchill's Second World War and the statement is quite correct. Not a single mention of Nazi gas chambers, a genocide of the Jews, or of 6 million Jewish victims of the war. This is astonishing. How can it be explained? Eisenhower's Crusade in Europe is a book of 559 pages, the six volumes of Churchill's Second World War, total 4,448 pages, and de Gaulle's three-volume Memoirs de Guerre is 2,054 pages. In this mass of writing, which altogether totals 7,061 pages, not including the introductory parts, published from 1948 to 1959, one will find no mention either of Nazi gas chambers, a genocide of the Jews, or of 6 million Jewish victims of the war. On December 6, David Cameron is elected leader of the British Conservative Party. Cameron is an old favourite of the Rothschilds, having been special advisor to Norman Lamont when he collapsed the British economy for them in 1993. Cameron is also related to the British royal family. Interestingly, the organization, Conservative Friends of Israel, boasts proudly on their website that over two-thirds of Britain's Conservative members of Parliament are members. Indeed, they even got David Cameron to complete a questionnaire for them prior to his election as leader, in which he stated the following: Israel is in the front line in the international struggle against terrorist violence. Another organization, presumably in complete opposition to the Conservative Friends of Israel, is called the Labour Friends of Israel. They choose not to reveal how many Labour members of Parliament are members. They do, however, state that they have sent at least 50 on expenses paid trips to Israel since 1997. Despite this intense political lobbying, official government figures reveal that Jews represent less than half of 1% of the British population. Also on December 6, President Bush's wife, Laura Bush, is joined by Rabbi Binyamin Taub, Rabbi Hillel Baron and Rabbi Mendy Minkowitz for the kosherization of the White House kitchen. A photo of this taking place as they stand with staff is shot by Sheila Crayhead and subsequently placed on the official White House website. 2006. Hamas is elected to power in the Palestinian elections in January. This is exactly what Israel want, as it gives them the excuse to get rougher, if that's possible, with the Palestinians. Immediately following Hamas election, Israel demand that aid be cut off to Palestine, and this is dutifully done by the United States, the European Union, and Canada. The result of this is, of course, what the Jews have always wanted: widespread suffering in Palestine, supporting Israel's long-term goal of the genocide of the entire Palestinian people who refuse to leave Palestine. It also benefits Israel's long-term aims in the Middle East, as former Mossad agent Viktor Ostrovsky prophetically stated on page 252 of his 1994 book, The Other Side of Deception. Supporting the radical elements of Muslim fundamentalism sat well with the Mossad's general plan for the region. An Arab world run by fundamentalists would not be a party to any negotiations with the West, thus leaving Israel again as the only democratic, rational country in the region. And if the Mossad could arrange for the Hamas, Palestinian fundamentalists, to take over the Palestinian streets from the PLO, then the picture would be complete. The Edmund de Rothschild Bank, a subsidiary of Europe's Edmund de Rothschild Family Bank Group in France, becomes the first foreign family bank that obtains approval of the China Banking Regulatory Commission and enters China's financial market. On March 5th to 7th, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, holds their annual convention in Washington, D.C. More than half of all United States senators and one-third of all United States congressmen attend. The Anti-Defamation League, AD, ruthlessly leans on governments throughout the world to pass hate crimes legislation, as they are scared that the Jewish criminal cabal is being exposed more and more on a daily basis, predominantly on the internet. Their job is to protect this criminal network, and what better way to do it than by passing so-called hate crimes laws, in which anyone who exposes a Jewish criminal, in turn becomes a criminal. This hate crimes legislation is promoted in protecting other things, namely ethnic minorities. It is interesting that these Jewish organizations are so keen on forcing laws on countries throughout the world that might seem somewhat contradictory to their own position when you consider the following. 1. Israel only allows Jews to emigrate to Israel and offers them financial incentives for doing so. 2. Israeli law forbids the marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. 3. Israel does not allow non-Jews to purchase property within the country. And most interestingly, 4. Israel does not allow non-Jews to own any media, although Jews see no problem with owning the vast majority of the rest of the world's media. British historian David Irving is sentenced to 3 years in jail in Austria for denying the alleged Holocaust of the Jews in World War II. It is important to note that the only historical event you can be arrested for questioning is this alleged Holocaust. The Jews start to panic about being exposed and therefore up their attack on breaking down America by encouraging the illegal immigration of millions of Mexicans into America, and then using their lobby groups to get the government to give them all amnesty. The idea is manifold, but it includes using their centuries-old policy of divide and conquer, getting cheap labor for the multinational companies they own, and using the social and economic problem of massive Mexican immigration to divert the Americans' attention from Jewish supremacism. Why is it that Jews love mass immigration into every country, apart from their own, Israel? On July 12, two Israeli soldiers stray into Lebanese territory and are therefore arrested as prisoners of war by Lebanese forces. The Jewish media throughout the world screams that they have been kidnapped, yet make no reference to the fact that Israel have seized and imprisoned over 9,000 Palestinians without trial, and Israel starts bombing Lebanon indiscriminately, a country in which incidentally 40-45% of the population are Christian. Incidentally, in relation to the 9,000 Palestinians imprisoned without trial, Article 111 of Israeli law mandates that the government may detain any person whatsoever for an unlimited period, without trial and without declaring a charge. This was brought in with the founding of Israel, and has been gleefully adopted by other Jewish leaders such as President George W. Bush. And an attempt was made by Tony Blair to put a slight variation of this into British law. When the Jewish media report this conflict between Israel and Lebanon, they make no reference to the high preponderance of Christians in Lebanon and instead portray the people of Lebanon as a bunch of Muslim Al-Qaeda terrorists, and within a month well over 1,000 Lebanese men, women and children have been killed and a quarter of the country's population have been displaced. The war ends with Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon. Many Jews are not satisfied with this outcome and accuse Prime Minister Ehud Olmert of losing this war. However, when he appears before the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee on September 5, he states the claim that we lost is unfounded. Half of Lebanon is destroyed, is that a loss? To Jewish aspirations, is it indeed?